I think all the central banks are on crisis watch. They won't tell us, of course they won't, because they don't want to, you know, frighten us. But the central banks realize that rising interest rates are going to undermine the commercial banks.
This is Kaiser Johnson with Liberty and Finance, and this is the Miles Franklin Weekly Special for February 28th through March 7th, 2023, while supplies last. This week we feature two coins from the Royal Canadian Mint, the sought-after 2013 Silver Pronghorn Antelope at $3.99 over spot, and the 2022 Silver Maple at $3.40 over spot. The Silver Pronghorn Antelope was made for the Low Mintage Limited Run Wildlife Series, where just 1 million coins were minted over the course of 6 months, and then never issued again. With a focus on beautiful design, a face value of $5 Canadian, and RCM's strict 4/9 fine purity, these coins further add a degree of rarity to the mix. They come 25 to a tube, 500 to a box, and are available at just $3.99 over spot. We also have 2022 Silver Maples on special. Silver Maples were the first silver sovereign coins to be minted at 4/9 fine purity and remain one of the most in-demand coins today. They come 25 to a tube, 500 to a box, and are available at the lowest premium we've seen in more than a year, at just $3.40 over spot. Both coins this week are also IRA eligible, and if you'd like to learn more about a precious metals IRA, call us and we'll be happy to help you in that process. To order these specials or any of the many other options we have available, call us at 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237. We're available after hours and on weekends, and we look forward to speaking with you.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're always grateful to have this distinguished returning guest. Alistair MacLeod, a former bank director, joins us this Tuesday, February 28th, 2023. Alistair, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
That's my pleasure, DK.
I should have mentioned you're also head of research at goldmoney.com, and you're widely followed for people who want to keep a finger on the pulse of the health or ill health of the global and regional and national banking and credit markets. And you've pointed out to us over time the strains and fragility building in those areas. We would like to check in with you for the latest developments that have your attention and that we should be aware of if there's concerns present at this time in the banking and credit markets. One of the things that we've been cautioned about is increased levels of overnight liquidity injections by the Fed to try to keep banks, and not just U.S. banks, but European banks rolling along. Any awarenesses that we need to have in that regards that you want to share?
Yeah, I think as we speak, actually, the big development that I see is that the yield on the 10-year Japanese government bond has suddenly shot through the ceiling imposed by the Bank of Japan at 0.5%. It's now trading at 0.537. Now, that might not seem like a lot, but the problem that they have is that the Bank of Japan is so far behind the curve. I mean, they've got inflation, which is the core index hit a 41-year record in February. Inflation rose to 4.3% in February, which is the highest since 1981. So, you know, they've got an inflation problem. Now, it's, you know, not as dramatic as 6.2 or whatever it is last seen in the United States, but this is definitely a problem. They have got negative interest rates at the short end. I mean, looking at my screen here, 1 month Japanese bonds yield minus 0.18. They haven't moved at all. All they've done is they've sort of just let the long end of the yield curve just rise a little bit. But their problem is that they're trying to suppress it by cornering the market. I mean, they bought over half all 10-year JGBs in existence. What's happening is that the Bank of Japan has got itself an enormous headache, because if it lets yields run to where they should be, which in my estimation is somewhere between 4.5% and 5%, the whole of the Japanese banking system is bust. Because on a 10-year bond, that would lose roughly 30% of the value. So you know, this is serious stuff. I mean, it really is. And the Bank of Japan's own balance sheet is so stuffed with bonds. I mean, they've been doing QE since the year 2000, so that's 23 years of quantitative easing. They have accumulated an awful lot on their balance sheet. Their equity, I think, is something like 100 million yen or something. I mean, you know, which is peanuts compared with the losses that they've accumulated. I mean, the Bank of Japan is in a really difficult situation. Now, I think inevitably it's going to blow. And what we've seen today is it's beginning to blow because having raised the guideline to 0.5% either side of zero, which is the way they put it, you know, it's now breached that level and it's just going to go shooting up even further. I don't know what they can do to stop it. I don't think they can do anything to stop it. So we've got a crisis actually starting in Japan as we speak, as this video, which is what? We're Tuesday, the 28th of February at 5 o'clock in the evening UK time, midday your time. So that, I think, is the most important development that we've seen, certainly recently. And this has a knock-on effect because put yourself in the position of Japanese banks where they have investments elsewhere. I mean, already they have been selling down their investments in French bonds. I mean, that was reported two, 3 weeks ago. And interestingly, the yield on 10-year French bonds is now nudging into new high ground. The yield on German bonds is now in high ground. I mean, you know, it's broken above previous highs. The yield on US treasuries, UK gilts and all the rest of it are on the rise. So what we're seeing, I think, is another attack on financial asset values. I mean, as to why it's rising, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, we're talking ourselves into a recession. In fact, we're almost hoping for a recession because we think it might cure inflation. Well, good luck with that one. Meanwhile, the Chinese economy is recovering. If you just look at the way money supply is increasing, you can see that credit is increasing in that economy. They're reopening after their prolonged COVID shutdowns. They're dealing with their property crisis, and they're dealing with it, I think, quite constructively. And they've got enormous prospects for investment all the way around Asia. And the great thing about the Chinese economy is they've got the savings to back it. I mean, the savings rate in Japan is an unbelievable 40%+. It just means that the capital is available out of the banking system to invest in projects all around Asia. I mean, this is the basis of the deal with the Saudis, for example. You know, Saudis will sell oil to China and accept payment in renminbi. We know that this is dealing a mortal blow, if you like, against the petrodollar, or it'll turn out over time to be a mortal blow. Of that we can be sure. But what the Chinese are doing is they're looking at importing, I think, around about $61-62 billion worth of oil from Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, they're looking to invest about $60 billion of that back in various infrastructure developments, projects, and all the rest of it. So, you know, that's the way this is going. They have got the savings in their banking system to be able to do it because the citizens are saving some unbelievable amount, like 40% of everything they earn.
Could you clarify for me? We were talking about Japan, and then just the last minute or so, you've been talking about China.
Yeah, the link is that the Chinese economy is beginning to boom. At the same time, we're going to the toilet. What this does to the commodity prices is it drives them up. And I think analysts are beginning to see that you're not going to get the you know, what they would normally expect a recession to do, to reduce demand for commodities, to reduce demand for manufactured goods, to reduce demand for consumer goods while the consumer's sort of getting unemployed. I mean, This is the Keynesian view of what a recession is. It is a, if you like, a product or a commodity glut. The commodity glut is not going to happen. That's the first thing. The second thing is that when it comes to the product glut, that's not going to happen either. Why? Because the people who produce stuff basically are going to go out, you know, they're going to lose their jobs. In other words, you know, production is going to go down as well as consumption. So this is a point that Keynesian economists get consistently wrong. I mean, they believe that you can get a general glut. You cannot get a general glut. You can get gluts in certain areas. I mean, if you go back to the 1930s, there was a glut in farm produce. And the reason there's a glut in farm produce was, I suppose, twofold. I mean, first of all, the credit for the farmers was being withdrawn because the banks were going bust and they were trying desperately to reduce their exposure. And the second thing is, of course, there had been widespread mechanization of farming, in farming methods. I mean, the tractor had been invented shortly before. I mean, really, in the 1920s, and it sort of spread everywhere around the world. I mean, we were farming in Kenya, my family, and, it did make a huge difference. I mean, instead of employing huge quantities of labor to till the fields, we mechanized. And, of course, the effect on production was massive. So there was a production glut in that instance. But the idea that there's a general production glut is wrong. So what we're seeing is, not only are we not going to get that general glut, which everybody relies on to, you know, get inflation, price inflation back down to 2% or whatever, and therefore allow the Fed to stimulate and lower interest rates and rescue bonds and all the rest of it. That's not going to happen. And at the same time, the Chinese are going gung-ho with their economy, which basically means that there's going to be continuing demand for energy, commodities, and all the rest of it, which is going to tend to push the prices up. And that's even before we talk about the effect, if you like, of central bank management of credit driving down the purchasing power of fiat currencies, which, of course, is a factor that which no analyst that I can see in the mainstream actually understands. I mean, they never mention it. You know, I mean, they're always asked to produce forecasts. Their forecasts are that so-and-so will rise or whatever. Never ever do they mention we expect the dollar to fall and therefore, you know, its purchasing power is going to mean that commodity prices or, you know, this price or that price is going to change accordingly. I mean, they just don't understand it. And I think it's very important that people do understand that most of the price change that we're going to get is actually going to come not so much from the commodities as such, but from a declining purchasing power of fiat currencies. And it's a situation which is being exacerbated by this, you know, the sun is setting in the west and it's rising in the east. And analysts are just beginning to understand that. And I think this is one of the major factors driving up bond yields when everybody's talking about recession.
Now, when you talk about this east-west split, I assume you're lumping Japan actually with the Western financial edifice in there, but clarify to us whether you consider, because you started this whole discussion saying the biggest concern right now, present crisis is exhibiting itself in Japan. So fair enough question just from the cheap seats is, why do we care? Why do people in the Western banking system care if Japan central bank is in trouble?
We care because so much of the derivatives market is funded out of cheap yen buying dollars. I mean, the yield pickup, as I said earlier, I mean, the 1 month Japanese bonds are yielding minus 0.18 now. The equivalent in America is what? 5 and a bit percent. So what's not to like to go along to your friendly bank and say, I'd like to borrow some yen, sell them in the market, buy dollars with it, and pick up the yield and do it many times, you know, leverage this up. Well, it's wonderful. I mean, you know, ignoring the risks, of course, it's wonderful. But what it means is that when the interest rate seen in Japan starts going wrong, you're going to have a lot of people running for cover, which basically means they've got to buy those yen back and sell the dollar. And a banking crisis then ensues because there are going to be enormous losses from the unwinding of a carry trade, which has really been going on for the last 20 or 30 years. That's why it matters.
And does the Fed's action to, when we hear that they're sending enormous amounts of funds overseas to prop up different banks, or maybe you can tell us why you believe these funds are being sent from the U.S. Fed to foreign banks, and if there's specific ones that you're aware of, and why that would be happening at this time?
Well, I think all the central banks are on crisis watch. They won't tell us. Of course they won't, because they don't want to, you know, frighten us. But central banks realize that rising interest rates are going to undermine the commercial banks, and they undermine them two ways. First of all, where they have got exposure into financial assets, those financial assets fall in value. Mark-to-markets basically start eroding shareholder value, and before very long, shareholder capital gets wiped out, if it continues. And what they want to do on the interest rate side is they want to appear responsible without actually addressing the issue too much, because if they did that properly, then the whole system would start falling over. And the second problem, which of course everybody's aware of, is that rising interest rates means that an awful lot of malinvestments are going to come unstuck. And it was interesting, I was preparing an article for Thursday, and I was looking at some charts from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I was absolutely amazed that of their commercial loans and leases, American banks, I mean, there's up to 40% of the loans and leases from American banks are of maturity of over 5 years. In other words, they are horribly illiquid in a crisis. And if you look at the level of leverage, balance sheet leverage, again, working off the FDIC figures and charts, you can see that they are more leveraged now than they were at the time of the Lehman crisis. And you might ask yourself, why aren't the banks taking large deposits? Because the large deposits are going to, the reverse repos at the Fed, which is now over, what, $2 trillion or something. I haven't looked at it in last week or so, but it's in excess of $2 trillion. Now, that's $2 trillion taken out of bank deposits. If you added that back in, you wouldn't be seeing money supply contracting, which, the statistics show M3 is now turning off, or M2. Consequently, you really should add those back in, and you see that that's still taking off. But these, we're talking about the American banking system basically has run out of balance sheet capacity. That is why the Fed is having to pick up the large deposits through a reverse repo facility, which has been rolling and rolling and rolling for the last 6 months now. The reason that large deposits are not favored by the banks is because of Basel III. Under Basel III, as a source of funding your assets, large deposits are disfavored compared with small deposits for obvious reasons. I mean, if you get large deposits taken out, you've got to run around and try and, So I can understand that. But it means that we have the situation, I don't know if they're doing it in America, but JP Morgan have set up a retail banking unit, which they call Chase, here in the UK. I guess they're probably doing the same in America. Why? Because small deposits are the best form of funding assets in a balance sheet. They want to up the retail content and get rid of the big stuff. And that's overall, it's quite obvious that the U.S. banking system has not got the capacity within the regulations, in the balance sheet capacity, to handle the amount of credit which is swanning around the economy. So the Fed has to sort of hide it in the form of reverse repos. Everything is creaking, I think, is the way to describe it. And I come back to this Japanese 10-year bond. I mean, It is, that market is so mispriced. Market forces are going to force the Japanese bond market into far higher yields. And there is nothing, at the end of the day, there's nothing the Bank of Japan can do about it. The Bank of Japan itself is bust. It needs to recapitalize itself. No, it can recapitalize itself, but I mean, the recapitalization is going to be so dramatic. I mean, when you see the equity rising from 100, I think it's 100 million yen. I mean, it was peanuts, absolute peanuts. When that rises to a few trillion yen just to absorb the losses, I mean, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to go, what? What's going on here? And I mean, in the UK, on the subject of central banks, I think it was at the tail end of last week, or it might have been over the weekend, we discovered that the UK Treasury is going to ask Parliament for more funds. They need another 200 billion sterling, basically to pay for the guarantee they gave to the Bank of England that they would absorb any losses on QE. So that's another bit of fun for us, if you like. The Bank of England is underwritten by the UK Treasury. Who funds the UK Treasury? The Bank of England. So we've got this sort of circle, which I think market participants at some stage are going to say, well, hold on a minute, what the hell is going on here? And of course, we've also got the situation with the Fed. I mean, the Fed's balance sheet is, on a mark-to-market basis, is way underwater. I mean, there have been various articles in the Wall Street Journal on this and all the rest of it. And the Fed has responded by saying, well, mark-to-market doesn't matter because we're going to hold these to maturity. Well, yeah, sure. At least, that means that if you're going to do QE at a later stage, I mean, the whole system is just completely falling apart. I mean, it really is. You can't ignore market values and say, well, we'll just hold it to maturity. I mean, yeah, great. I think the Fed probably can do that to an extent insofar as the debt profile of the US government is relatively short term compared with the other Western governments. But, and the ECB, I mean, the ECB is in a horrid position as well, because, I mean, they're almost as bad as the Bank of Japan. And as I said earlier, I mean, we're seeing the 10-year yields on French government and German government bonds breaking into new high ground. This is very, very bad news for the euro area. It really is. And when we look at Switzerland, we've already seen one bank get into trouble. Credit Suisse, which in former times was the blue chip baby and blue chip bank in Switzerland. That's where the gentlemen were, whereas UBS were the white boys. I mean, you know, it's all fallen apart. Anyway, there we go. That's this bond yields situation. Do not ignore it.
We've been having a similar sounding conversation for almost a decade, talking about over-leveraged banking system and the fragility of the derivative complex, that any disruption of this entire house of cards could have a knock-on effect that could affect the entire global system. And you mentioned just now, for example, the Japanese keep drawing a line in the sand and the yields go beyond, they can't defend that. Okay, they're going to draw a different line and then the yields go beyond that. They can't defend that anymore. People have said that if Powell were to throw in the towel and pivot and start having to do QE again, that would lose all credibility of the Fed, and that people would finally realize there's no faith to have confidence there. Who are the parties whose confidence is going to be lost, and what would it really take to cause that? Because if you look at it as closely as you have been outlining it for us for a long time, people take sometimes divergent takeaways from that. Some people say, yeah, people should have given up long ago because this thing is all just a house of cards. It's all just smoke and mirrors. It's all just misdirection and there's nothing really substantial behind it. Or other people say, nah, if they've been keeping it going this long, they'll just keep it going as long as they want to. What say you about what is actually behind that idea of a tidal sea change in confidence, and is it in corporate borrowers? Is it in who's holding out confidence now that's going to give it up later based on these changes that are becoming more and more obvious in the banking system?
Well, I think basically we're talking about the currency in this instance. I mean, I think we've covered the, you know, what happens with rising interest rates drives down financial asset values, particularly bonds, makes funding the budget deficit and existing, you know, sort of rolled over bonds and all the rest of it for the government, you know, increasingly expensive. I mean, there's a chart which looks like a hockey stick in existence on that one. But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to the currency. And almost all the Americans I talk to think I'm being alarmist. Now, this is entirely natural. And I'll tell you why. Because there are two worlds when it comes to evaluating a currency. You've got the domestic users and the foreign users. When the trouble for a currency starts, it is always the foreign holders who recognize the trouble first and start reducing their positions. We're already seeing that foreign buyers are not stepping up to the plate for US treasuries. Well, the ones that are effectively offshore American entities, insurance companies based in the Caymans and so on and so forth. So the foreigners, I think, are looking at the dollar with increasing skepticism. And remember that of the $30 trillion, which is recorded in the U.S. Treasury tick figures as being old, and you know, these are financial assets and deposits held by foreigners, something like $12 trillion of that is in portfolio investments, equities in effect. And maybe corporate bonds. I think corporate bonds are in addition to that $12 trillion. So put yourself in the foreigner's shoes. I mean, if you're going to see interest rates start rising, you know what's going to happen to the S&P. You know what's going to happen to your portfolio investments in a foreign country. Do you really want to have that? No. So you start selling it down. So what you're going to see is you are going to see, instead of the dollar being accumulated by everybody on the basis, you know, this sort of Triffin dilemma thing that the foreigners will always need dollars, which all my American friends tell me is still the case, that is no longer true. And it is particularly not true following, to my mind, the strategic mistake that the U.S. government made in sanctioning Russia and cutting it out of the SWIFT thing, because basically what we've done is we've weaponized our currencies. Now, that has sent a very clear signal all around Asia. And if you're looking at the Russian-Chinese sphere of influence, this is 3.8 billion people rapidly industrializing. Well, we're quietly sinking into the mire of our wokeness and, you know, we want to be responsible energy, non-fossil fuel and all the rest of it. I mean, they have got the message very, very clearly where these currencies, these fiat currencies are going. And it's not going to take very much, in my view, for them to, you know, to start, you know, getting out of foreign investments, like, you know, and particularly dollars is the obvious candidate. And inevitably, what you see is that the initial stages, you will find that Americans, because they can only think in terms of their domestic use of their currency, and you know, and it's the same for the Brits, the same for the Europeans, and so on. I mean, it's, you know, this is not just something unique to America. This is normal. They will take the view that the foreigners, I just don't understand why the foreigners are selling our currency. They need it, for goodness sake. In other words, the average American is going to wake up rather late to what's happening to their own currency. And I think that's why it's not very well understood what's going on in America, why when you talk to Americans, you know, you get this sort of view that people like McLeod are probably being alarmist. But it's not alarmist. And, you know, the other thing is that the plans which are sort of gradually being revealed, and it's very gradually, we have nothing firm yet, but the plans coming out of Russia for the Eurasian Economic Union is for them to establish a trade currency backed by gold. Now, that is going to change things very radically, because suddenly gold is going to come back into the monetary picture as far as the West is concerned. And what's going to be their response? I guess that they will deny that it has any validity. It's still a pet rock as far as they're concerned, whatever, whatever, whatever. I mean, you know, we're talking about economists who lost sight of economics back in the 30s, really. When countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia, who are between them, you know, produce so much of global energy, they can control the global energy price. They can't control the demand, but they can control the supply. To a large extent, they can set the price. And particularly when it comes to energy, that's a pretty inflexible thing. I mean, you know, we need it. It doesn't matter whether we're in a recession or whatever. You know, all this stuff about recessions. But of course, the Chinese, why did they secure a 27-year contract with Qatar? Because they know they're going to need the gas. Why do they need the gas? Because they've got plans to consume it. And why did President Xi go to Saudi Arabia and talk to MBS? Well, the answer is they need the oil, and they want the oil, and let's see if we can agree some terms which suit us rather than suit the Americans. MBS, no longer really in the American pocket. I mean, we saw that when President Biden visited. He was lucky to get 10 minutes with MBS, as far as I could gather. Whereas President Xi came in, you know, full reception, the whole thing. I mean, it was almost medieval, the seeing, you know, the horses galloping alongside the state cars and all the rest of it. But that's the way the world is going, and we've got to recognize it. It's bifurcating into two halves. And we're the smaller half. I mean, if you look at the Western Alliance, we're 1.1 billion people. The Asian Alliance, 3.8 billion. Their suppliers, another 2 billion. I mean, you know, we're in a small minority here. No, okay, we're the rich minority, but we're working very hard to make ourselves poor, that's for sure. And the whole idea of the Chinese and Russian alliance in Asia is not just a geopolitical strategic thing to diss the Americans, you know, and NATO. It's about industrializing the whole of the Asian Union to give a commercial future for both Russia and also China. And it's that we can't stand. It's that we hate. We hate their success. We want to stop them. That's actually what all this war stuff is all about.
You know, it's interesting. There's so many currents, layers and layers of currents here to explore. One of the things you just mentioned was we're doing a good job of making ourselves poorer. And I would say we're also doing a good job of making ourselves incompetent, because we've thrown out competency as the basis for getting into universities, getting positions at jobs, for companies to establish their leadership, for countries to install you know, presidents and vice presidents and things like that. And that's this part of this whole wokeness thing. So that's a whole other agenda that seems to be a layer below the surface. One thing that you haven't mentioned, you've mentioned quite a few impacts of downstream of interest rate changes, such as impact on equities and so on. What about real estate? There's been increasing concern, especially in the last few years, about the Chinese buying up America or foreigners buying up American assets, that sort of thing, the land itself, and et cetera. In the case of rising interest rates, where that causes a decrease in the value in the price of equities and also real estate, is that another countercurrent that we should talk about? Whether first there may be a divestiture or a sell-off of by foreigners of inflatedly priced American real estate, so that people should expect there could be this snowball effect where there'll be a significant decline, a waterfall decline in real estate prices in the U.S., or do you see something different ahead?
Well, I think you've got to look at different sectors, the real estate industry, differently. If we talk about residential start, foreign influence in residential is very minimal, really. And the pricing of residential is very dependent on mortgage rates, if you like. So as we see higher interest rates come through, that's obviously going to depress prices. Absolutely. But in terms of valuation, probably the most important metric is to see what a property will yield when it is let out, and look at that in relation to the, you know, the capital value. So that is going to turn negative under higher interest rates. So that is for sure. So that would drive property prices down. Put it more bluntly, people won't be able to afford to pay higher prices, you know, with mortgage costs soaring, which, you know, that, and that's a problem going to be everywhere. If that develops into a real currency collapse, then what happens is that the cost of maintaining a property then becomes higher than the rental income. And at that stage, it's pretty well valueless. So instead of inflation, you know, property, residential property being an inflation hedge, it then becomes a liability. There is a point where that probably happens, but I think it's worth mentioning because that definitely is, you know, that definitely happens. When it comes to commercial property, it depends on the commercial property. Farmland, for example, you will see the output, the value of the output rising, along with the collapse of the purchasing power of the currency. So that will tend to retain its value, might even increase its value. I mean, I think the point is that rising interest rates won't kill farmland values, if you like. That's important. And the same with anything, any property which is involved in the production of things that are needed by society. So the effect generally on commercial property, I would have thought would be generally somewhat less, a negative effect will be somewhat less than on residential property. But I think you've got to sort of look at it that way. You know, what is the property actually producing? Is it producing something which in an accelerating collapse of the currency scenario is still going to be needed? Because when the currency goes down, people get impoverished and they're not going to run out and, be able to spend as much in real terms as they've always been accustomed to. So, you know, when you get inflation, basically it depresses the economy. It pushes the economy into a real slump, not recorded because obviously, you know, GDP is purely a credit total, and you know, you can have GDP soaring off the charts, but what's the value of that GDP? You know, it's probably falling faster than the rise, as it were. So when it comes to property, I think that there will be lots of bargains to pick up in residential property. And the way I would look at it is that if you think, as I do, that we're going to see the end of the fiat currency era, then there will be life after fiat currencies. And residential property, commercial property, farmland, whatever can be bought on that basis. So the answer is, you know, I wouldn't own property at the moment, or I wouldn't own, obviously you need to have the security of a roof over your own head, but other property investments seems to me to be very vulnerable to a currency collapse.
You made a distinction there I think is salient that I wanted to touch on, and that was productive versus non-productive. America has been such a consumer economy for so long. Retail malls and storefronts and mini malls and restaurants and movie theaters and even frankly large corporate office buildings, that sort of thing, are still heavily
absolutely
under pressure.
But a lot of them are going to be shut down and surplus. Absolutely. Yeah. So their values, I think, worthless, really. I mean, the cost of maintaining these and also state taxes and things like that need to be paid and all the rest of it. I mean, it's, you know, they're a liability. They become a liability. Without the income, you don't want them.
Back on the topic of the East-West split and whether the East is going to come out with a commodity-backed currency, Russia, you mentioned, China's certainly talked about that, or people have expected them to for some time. Others have poo-pooed that, saying that the United States military backing of the dollar has proven itself over the last century to keep enforcing that the maintenance of the world reserve currency status will be defended with force. And you said, well, no, it's good things that are productive, and these countries have real things, and they're producing commodities, and they're producing valuable exports that people really need. It's kind of like, I think about it like a playground bully at a school. He may not have any real skill sets, but if he's the biggest and most toughest fighter or whatever, he can intimidate those who have to give over their lunch money or whatever. So what about that aspect, that the empire of the U.S. may be less productive, may be not commodity-based, may not have the energy that other countries have, but we've got the military might to force others to comply with our wishes in terms of the use of our fiat, et cetera. Your thoughts on that proposal?
Yeah, your analogy of the playground, I think, is apt, because a bully in a playground works as long as everybody in the playground is frightened of the bully. But, you know, that's no longer the case. I mean, as we saw with Mohammed bin Salman, you know, just look at, his relationship developing with President Xi and also Putin. Do you remember high five at a G20? And you could see from the body language that these guys had come to some sort of agreement, and it was sort of going, you know, great, you know, it was to do with that. And then President Biden turns up in early December and gets the cold shoulder. 2 weeks later, President Xi turns up and, you know, lauded and all the rest of it. I mean, the largest oil exporter in the world and the largest exporter of cheap energy, cheap oil, effectively has turned his back on America. So the playground bully is no longer commanding the respect which he probably formerly had. It's a very important point, because I really do think that that now the future of the dollar is more in the hands of President Putin than it is in the hands of the Fed or the US Treasury. Because going back to, I think it was June last year, the St. Petersburg International Forum, Putin stood up and, you know, just raised the question, you know, why have these currencies when they can be weaponized against you? And at that time, coincidentally, the US dollar was losing 6.2% of its purchasing power measured by CPI inflation. You know, why hold it? And he's saying, and why hold your gold in Western vaults? You know, it just makes no sense at all. So there were, I think, something like 81 nations officially attended that. I mean, obviously all, you know, Asian ones and Africans and a few Latin Americans, like, you know, Brazil and so on and so forth. They got the message. I mean, it's quite clear. And with rising interest rates now, I think this is probably the tipping point. We're coming up to the tipping point. Because I can just see Putin picking up the phone saying, you know, through our Chinese friends, we've just got rid of our last dollars. I recommend you do the same. What? You know, I can see this. I'm dramatizing, but basically, we know what's going to happen. They have been tipped the wink, and it's just a question of time before they suddenly realize we've got to get out of the dollar. We've got to get out of the euro. We've got to get out of sterling. We've got to get out of yen, because, you know, this is just not working. And at the same time, the other thing is that there is no doubt at all that Russia is moving towards a gold solution, a gold-backed solution to the currency issue. Just to refresh everybody's mind, at the beginning of last year, I think it was around about April, it was announced that Sergei Glazyev, who is a senior economist, Russian economist, was appointed to a new committee under the aegis of the Eurasian Economic Union, which incorporates Russia, Belarusia, and also various stans in, you know, were ex-Russian provinces, as it were, in the middle of Asia, to consider the construction of a new currency. And there have been various announcements along the way, and it's got refined down to a statement which Glazyev made. It wrote an article, actually, for a Russian business newspaper, published on the 27th of December, the day after the state-owned Sberbank came out with a gold-linked cryptocurrency, CBDC, sort of monkey, if you like, saying, effectively, gold is the way forward. And this is the man, incidentally, who's spearheading the development of the expanded Moscow Gold Exchange. The messages are quite clear. And in my last article, which you pick up on the Gold Money website, writing about CBDCs, which I called CBDCs, the good, the bad, the ugly. Well, CBDCs are completely unnecessary for this currency. But, you know, it's fashionable, I suppose. And it's, you know, there's some talk that they will do this new currency as a central bank digital currency. Completely unnecessary. But in that article, I wrote how such a system could well be designed. And if I was Sergei Glazyev, that's the way I would do it. But basically, you get a new central bank, which issues a new currency, which is 40% backed by gold. And the way in which existing central banks become a party to this is that they submit their gold into this new central bank, which they needn't really do. I mean, all they need do is if they've got it stored in a vault approved by the new central bank, then it just gets earmarked across for the new central bank, in return for which they will receive the new currency. It will be a gold substitute, if you like. But the great thing about 40% is that you put in a let's say, 1 million ounces, and you get the currency the equivalent to 2.5 million ounces back. So, you know, you can replace all your fiat currency reserves, no problem, immediately. And it's basically a currency which is independent of any currencies of the central banks which are, you know, which decide to join the scheme. And not only that, but you will find that the major banks in Asia, Chinese and Russians and, I mean, any bank really, can run credit balances in this new currency. It doesn't need to own the currency. And indeed, I recommend that they don't own the currency. I recommend that if they want gold cover to you know, sort of prudentially cover their credit obligations, and they go into the market and acquire gold. We've got enough sellers in the West, for goodness sake, or at least apparently, if it hasn't all been leased out already, but anyway, it probably has. So, you know, basically it's a trade finance system, and a lot of trade finance credit becomes self-extinguishing in effect. So, you know, it's easy. It really is easy. But as soon as we do that, then, of course, not only do we use this currency for settlements, but the whole idea is to get rid of the dollar in Asia. Well, the answer is that every commodity exchange in Asia, all commodity transactions will be priced in gold, in the new gold currency. Simple. Very, very simple.
You've written this proposed hypothetical gold-backed currency scenario, this thought experiment, in a recent article. If people want to read that article and all your other writing, where do they go?
Well, they go to Gold Money Research. It's goldmoney.com. Hit the research tab and you'll find my articles there. And I write an article published every Thursday. And I do a market report on Friday as well for, you know, people who are interested in precious metals. That might be an additional source of information for them.
We've got so many more questions to follow up with you, but we'll have to have that for our next get-together. And folks, so that you don't miss a single episode with Alistair or any of our other guests, make sure you go to libertyandfinance.com, put in your name, email address, click submit. Make sure you acknowledge the confirming email and you're in. One email per day in your inbox. We don't share your email address with anyone else, and you'll see every interview with Alistair and all of our other guests in your inbox, one per day. So thank you, Alistair, on behalf of all of our viewers, for joining us again on Liberty and Finance.
That's my pleasure.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A-plus rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we can let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH or electronic check, money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency. Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Kaiser, my brother Elijah, or my father Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.